The Legal Sunday, the historical aspect of the question, Chapter 3. The union of church and state, signalized by the promulgation of the First Sunday Law, gave free rein to the spirit of persecution. The theoretical right whereof was denied by no early sect, the discovery of toleration. But beyond mere toleration, the zeitgeist had not moved when America was discovered, nor when the English colonies were planted in North America. Distinction between toleration and equality among religions, religious equality expressly provided against in the fundamental law of every American colony. Just as soon as the professed Christian Church had substituted Constantine for Christ as its head and united itself with the pagan state of Rome, it began to use as a means of its own aggrandizement the weapons of persecution which had hitherto been used against it and had now come into its hands. And these weapons were wielded with perfect impartiality against pagans and against Christian sects which were so unfortunate as not to have the state's force at their command. Nor was this great apostasy a thing of brief duration, a passing frenzy, a false step soon retraced. It has never been retraced to this day. The spirit of persecution still dominates thousands who professedly follow the Master. The idea still lurks in many minds that belief may be superinduced by the vigorous application of the policeman's club to the heretical head, and that the conviction necessary to salvation can, somehow or other, be secured through a criminal proceeding. And the manifestations of this spirit meet and shame us at every stage of history, from Constantine to Victoria. Many sects of Christians arose from time to time. They differed from each other on almost every conceivable point, and on various utterly inconceivable points. But the right and the duty of persecution remained the one principle which they all held to in common, the blessed tie that bound together the disciples of him who should not strive nor cry. The sects which found themselves for the time being in opposition, so to speak, disputed neither the fair intentions of the dominant sect nor the general correctness of its actions, provided its premises were conceded. That it was a good thing to burn heretics was not doubted by the generality. The only question was, who were the heretics? Hence, each sect, as soon as it was able, began to burn heretics on its own account. All the sects objected to being persecuted. None of them understood religious liberty in any other sense than as liberty to them to persecute the rest. Of religious equality, none of them had any idea whatever. This is an important distinction, too often overlooked. When we read the earnest protests of many writers of the past against persecution, we are too prone to infer that they objected to persecution as such, like right thinkers of our age. But nothing could be farther from the facts. It was the exercise of violence and terror to make men disavow the truth which they objected to so strenuously. As soon as the believers in the truth had violence and terror at their command, they used them, as a matter of course, against the believers in error. And of course, like the right and duty of persecution, its necessary means, the union of church and state, was an accepted axiom with every sect. Each sect considered that it ought to form a part of the state and to have at its disposal the power of the state to persecute the other sects to its satisfaction. Now, one of the inevitable results of this way of thinking was to foster the very condition of things it was designed to prevent. Treason and heresy were not only regarded as synonymous by the ruling sect, but those whose real differences with that sect were merely on abstract questions of religion were driven into overt treason by the necessities of the case, though they had no original grievance against the government. Compelled to meet secretly and at night, to shelter and protect each other, it was inevitable that the dissentients should combine and set up a sort of imperium in imperio, which the government, in turn, was bound to crush for its own preservation. But, as the time wore on, through long experience, two discoveries were made. One was that persecution could not be relied on as an infallible specific for heresy, that, while it sometimes proved effectual, as when the Albigenses were practically exterminated, it almost always resulted in an extension, instead of the suppression, of objectionable doctrines. And the other discovery was that, if they were not treated a priori as traitors and pursued accordingly, people might repudiate the state religion and yet remain good, reliable, patriotic citizens, such as, for its own sake, the state ought not to kill or maim or exile. Political expediency and practical experience thus cooperated to develop the wonderful idea of toleration. But humanity was beginning to awaken also. Contemplating the horrors of persecution, men began to inquire not only into their effectiveness, but into their necessity, conceding that they accomplished the end in view of making converts. Creeds now began to be threshed over, and disputes to arise among the admittedly orthodox as to many of their multitudinous minor points. Their very length and complexity led to differences of interpretation and prepared men's minds for the conception that there might be some distinction between beliefs necessary to salvation and beliefs not necessary thereto, and that it might not really be a Christian duty to burn a man to death by way of satisfying his mind about these last. And so toleration came to be a thing spoken of with apologetic approval, practiced to a limited extent, yet fiercely repudiated and denounced in many influential quarters. In the direction of toleration, then, the general opinion, the zeitgeist or time spirit of Europe, had begun to move when Columbus set sail for America. The ceaseless theological controversies of the 12th century had shaken the unity of the Church and continued to bear their fruit during the 13th and 14th centuries in the development of heterodox sects, as well as conflicting schools claiming the right to remain within the Orthodox fold, which they denied to others. Sectarianism had even been inaugurated and defended by ordained priests of the Catholic Church. The spectacle of rival claimants to the papal chair had suggested to the popular mind that differences on very important topics of religion were not necessarily incompatible with the preservation of social order. Each had excommunicated the other and appealed to the laity for support, thus invoking the exercise of that right of private judgment hitherto denied. But so slightly felt by the zeitgeist was the influence of this idea of toleration that the worst infamies of persecution were committed after 1492. The torture and massacre of pagans in the beginning of the union of church and state were yet to be outdone in the torture and massacre of Christians whose creed was not that established by civil law. By the time that the English began to colonize this country, the pendulum had swung back again. Other influences, cooperating with the spirit of commerce, had given rise to the movements directed by Luther and Zwinglius and Calvin. But beyond a faint recognition of the policy of toleration, to an uncertain extent and under uncertain conditions, beyond the conception that it was an important experiment, worth trying, though fraught with serious dangers, the zeitgeist of the English colonization period had not advanced. It still accepted the idea that belief could be influenced by assault, and that it was a sacred duty to make the assault when the belief was wrong on any vital point. But it was slowly and with many painful contortions assimilating the thought that some points of religious belief might not be vital, and that as to such points, the receiving and even the preaching of doctrines contrary to those of the Church by law established might be tolerated. Such, too, was the time spirit which dominated the minds of the American colonists. They were in no respect ahead of their day. Some of them, as will presently appear, were more advanced than others. That is to say, they were inclined to extend the lines of toleration farther. Beyond an extension of toleration, none of them dreamed of going. Of religious equality, that is to say, of the absolute equality of all forms of religion and of no religion before the law, they had no notion whatever. If the notion had been propounded to them, they would have pronounced it the equivalent of anarchy. It was broached, indeed, by individuals here and there. But it was a dangerous thing to do, as it is in every age, to pit the individual judgment against the zeitgeist. And, with the exception of one single case to be mentioned again presently, and so extraordinary that it deserves to be called a latter-day miracle of Christianity, it was never accepted as a theory, nor put in practice, even experimentally. Upon no false assumption in history have more lies of fact and of inference been based than upon the false assumption that religious equality, as right thinkers define and defend it today, that is, the absolute equality of all religions and of no religion before the law, was understood by any considerable number of men when this country was first colonized. And the equally false assumption that any body of English colonists had grasped such an idea, or were influenced by it, or entertained the slightest notion of establishing religious equality on these shores. Pride of ancestry is neither good nor bad in itself. Like pride in general, it is a sentiment whose value is measured by its effect upon conduct. In some, it breeds arrogance, insolence, idleness, inhumanity. In others, it is a stimulus to purity of life, honesty, high and noble aspirations, a conscientious discharge of duty without regard to consequences. So with national pride. In the history of every nation there is enough to be proud of, and for each generation to strive to equal or surpass, and it is good to dwell on these things so long as we are thereby inspired to emulate them. American history is full of illustrations of the highest attributes of which our nature is capable, of bravery, of self-sacrifice, of laborious industry, of endurance, fidelity, and all things good and great. These are our moral inheritance, the capital of idealism handed down to us, which it is ours to reinvest in right living and pass on in large to those who shall come after us. But if we are to be profited by the past, it is essential that we should study our history honestly and impartially. We cannot be true to ourselves if we begin by being false with our predecessors. If we credit them with motives they did not feel and could not have understood, if we claim for them things which they never accomplished, if we defend their indefensible acts, if we seek to prove them in the right when they were in the wrong in their behavior toward others, it will follow that we will deal likewise in our own case and prove dishonest and tricky as a nation and in our personal transactions. Moreover, we thus expose ourselves to constant danger of mortification and loss. In this age of investigation and inquiry, our false gods are liable at any moment to be overthrown and to have their rottenness exposed under the searchlight of the scientific method. And when a cherished set of ideals is dissipated, the process of replacing them is slow and painful, and to many mental constitutions it is impossible. No better instance of this unreasonable way of writing history can be found than the claim so brazenly urged on behalf of the first American colonists that they were the champions of religious equality as we understand it. In fact, as observed above, religious equality as we now understand it was not understood at all when these colonists came from Europe, save by a few persons whose lives were in constant danger for their premature perspicuity. And, without a single exception, religious equality was carefully guarded against under every colonial administration. It has happened also, by a singular and perverse fatality, that this false pretense has been most strongly and incessantly put forward on behalf of the only colonists who came hither for the express purpose of founding a theocracy of their own, who did, in fact, set up the only independent, formally established church that ever existed in this country, who alone of all the colonists seriously persecuted for religion's sake, who vied with the worst fanatics of Europe in the ferocity and relentless cruelty of their persecutions, and whose annals are stained with atrocities so infamous that one is amazed to find their descendants inviting discussion of the subject, instead of allowing it to drop, as completely as may be, into oblivion. Nor is it necessary to apply the unfair standard of our better times to these bigots in order to reprobate their ways. They stand out in broad contrast with their fellows as the only actively aggressive persecutors on American soil. We are sorry that toleration should have been universally accepted in lieu of religious equality, and that it should have been imagined that toleration had reached its reasonable limits when it was extended to all Christian sects. We regret to read of the banishment of Quakers and the expulsion of Papists from soil procured for the settlers by one of the best Papists and best men that ever lived. But the American patriot's cheek never kindles with shame till the story of the New England Puritans is told. Theirs alone is the dishonor of the torture, the mutilation, and the scaffold. But beyond toleration, none of the American colonists nor others of their day had advanced a step. Now, toleration, of course, implies superiority. It is an act of condescension, of forbearance, by the higher and better toward the lower and worse. It involves the right to persecute and destroy, and the grace which forbears. It is plain that the idea of religious toleration is utterly inconsistent with the idea of religious equality. Perhaps no man who understands the true nature of religious beliefs or of sincere unbelief in matters of religion will admit that one position on such subjects is just as good as another. Certainly no man who has a religion of his own and appreciates and values it as he should will be content to have his profession and practice of it tolerated by the professors and practicers of any other religion as an act of condescension from the better to the worse. It has been said that religious equality was carefully guarded against in every colonial administration. Thus, in Carolina, no man could have the benefit of the laws, or own property, or be a freeman, who did not acknowledge the existence of a God who was to be publicly worshipped, and the Church of England was declared to represent the only true and orthodox religion. One Story on the Constitution, Volume 1, page 33. And this, under a constitution drawn up by John Locke, a man who knew better, as his writings show. Later, in South Carolina, a liberty of conscience was proclaimed which did not extend to a denial of the Trinity. 2 Id, page 140. North Carolina considered that she was doing all that could reasonably be expected of her when she confirmed the laws existing previous to her separation from South Carolina for the indulgence of Protestant dissenters. 3 Id, page 142. In Georgia's original charter, the free exercise of religion was granted to all except Papists. 1 Id, page 143. In Virginia, under the first charter, the English Church was established by law. 2 Bancroft's History of the United States, Volume 1, page 123. Later, courts-martial had authority to punish indifference with stripes and infidelity with death. 3 Itty, page 143. And the legislature afterward confined the protection of the charter to those who believed in the Trinity and the divine inspiration of the Scriptures. 4 Story on the Constitution, Volume 1, page 125. And though the Catholic Lord Baltimore, when driven from his own province of Maryland, found a refuge in Virginia. 5 Bancroft's History of the United States, Volume 1, page 197. Though the Puritans of Plymouth were invited to make the shores of Delaware Bay their home. 6 Itty, page 198. And though some Massachusetts people did actually emigrate to Virginia. 7 Itty, page 206. Yet in 1643 it was forbidden to preach or teach privately or publicly except in conformity to the constitutions of the Church of England, and nonconformists were banished. 8 Itty, page 207. And in 1658 Quakers were expelled and their return regarded as a felony. 9 Itty, page 231. Bancroft says, however, that though the laws in Virginia were severe, the administration was mild. Itty, page 206. And in fact, we find that when Governor Berkeley forbade the Puritan preachers to hold public services, the people resorted to them in their private houses to hear them, and Puritan authority says nothing of interference with these private meetings. See Campbell's History of Virginia, page 203. Though another preacher who followed the first three was ordered by Berkeley to leave. Itty, page 211. The Presbyterians early obtained a foothold in Virginia, and the followers of that faith do not appear to have been interfered with. Itty, pages 438, 446. By the Charter of Maryland, Christianity was made the law of the land, though no preference was given to any sect. 10. Bancroft's History of the United States, Volume 1, page 243. But the idea of toleration had not gotten beyond Christians. And in 1649, an act was passed to punish with death, followed by confiscation of all his lands and goods to the proprietary, anyone who should blaspheme God, or deny Jesus Christ to be the Son of God, or deny the Holy Trinity, or use any reproachful speeches concerning the Holy Trinity or any person thereof. 1. Scharf's History of Maryland, Volume 1, page 174. 2. Itty, page 153. Thus, Jews and Unitarians were left out, and the former were not eligible to office in Maryland till 1825. 2.
New York passed an act condemning to perpetual imprisonment all popish priests remaining in the colony after a certain date, and death if any escaped and were retaken. 3 Story on the Constitution, Volume 1, page 75. Persecution was occasionally resorted to by Stuyvesant, the Dutch governor of New Netherlands. It was always rebuked by the company in Holland which he represented, and the persecuted of every creed were invited by the kind and hospitable Dutch. Bancroft's History of the United States, Volume 1, pages 300-302. In New Jersey, liberty of conscience was allowed to all persons but Papists. 4 ID, page 120. 5 ID, pages 123-124, and Frame of Government, 1683, Article 34. Pennsylvania guarded against molestation all who believed in one Almighty God, and all who possessed faith in Jesus Christ were eligible to office. 5. In the colony of New Haven, the identification of church and state was complete, and the scriptures were adopted as a code of laws. 6. Bancroft's History of the United States, Volume 1, page 404. Story on the Constitution, Volume 1, page 85. Much the same state of things prevailed in Connecticut, where all were required by law to attend at the established church, and Quakers and other notorious heretics were required to be imprisoned or banished. 7. Story on the Constitution, Volume 1, pages 90-92. The law against Quakers, says Bancroft, never was enforced. Bancroft's History of the United States, Volume 3, page 70. 8. ID. Story on the Constitution, Volume 1, page 80. 9. ID, page 74. 10. ID. By the Charter of New Hampshire, liberty of conscience was allowed to all Protestants only. 8. In the colony of Massachusetts, heresy was punished with fines, banishment, and in obstinate cases, with death. 9. And attendance on public worship, sustained by the state, was enforced by the penalty of a fine. 10.
In Rhode Island, the principles of that marvelous man, Roger Williams, found full expression at one time. When her charter was granted, it was expressly provided that no person within the said colony shall be anywise molested, punished, disquieted, or called in question for any difference in matters of religion. Every person may at all times freely and fully enjoy his own judgment and conscience in matter of religious concernment. 1. Bancroft's History of the United States, Volume 2, pages 63-64. Story on the Constitution, Volume 1, page 97. It has been well said this charter did not limit freedom to religious sects alone. It granted equal rights to the paynim and the worshipper of foe. To the disciples of Confucius, it was, on the part of a Christian prince, no more than an act of reciprocal justice. The Charter of Rhode Island was granted just 1 year after the Emperor of China had proclaimed the enfranchisement of Christianity among the 100 millions of his people. See Bancroft's History of the United States, Volume 2, page 62. Yet later, Rhode Island by statute excluded Papists from its established equality. 2 ID, Volume 3, page 69. Story on the Constitution, Volume 1, page 98, and authority cited. As to the founders of the colony of New Plymouth, those Pilgrim Fathers of whom we hear so much, they allowed that a man ought not to be deprived of his life, limb, or property, except with certain preliminaries,
or by virtue of the known law of God, known, of course, to themselves alone. 3. Laws of the Colony, 241. They made heresy a statutory crime, subjecting the offender to banishment. 4. ID 248. They punished with death anyone who should willfully deny the true God or his creation and government of the world, meaning their God and their theory of his works. 5. ID 244. Quoting Leviticus 24, verse 15, 16, as their authority for passing such a law.
They disfranchised everybody who was not sound in the fundamentals of religion, meaning everybody who did not accept their religion in its entirety, and also whoever should alter his views on this subject so as to become an apostate. 6 ID 258. They fixed the death penalty for anyone who, having had the knowledge of the true God, afterward worshipped any other than the Lord God. 7 ID 244, meaning their God, and they would not allow even him to be worshipped in any manner not ordained by themselves. Thus, they forbade any public meeting to be held without the approval of the general court. 1 ID 103. There is no adjective religious before the noun meeting in this law. Under its provisions, the common law right of Englishmen peaceably to assemble at any time and petition for the redress of grievances was taken away at one fell blow, and no meeting of any kind whatsoever could be held by the unfortunate people of Plymouth Colony, save by the gracious permission of that cruel and relentless central despotism, the General Court. In this regard, as in many others, the position of the Plymouth colonists under the sway of the noble representatives of freedom who guided and controlled their destinies was not one whit better than that of the Russian peasants in the hands of the Tsar's administrative police. 2 ID 93. And especially the holding of religious assemblies in any way contrary to God and the allowance of the government. 2. They generously proffered the assistance of the central despotism, the general court, to towns in setting up churches, in order that faithful preachers might be secured. 3. Meaning thereby to prevent the towns from selecting their ministers without submitting to the judgment of the general court the orthodoxy of their choice, and forbade the setting up of any church different from those already set up and approved without the consent of the government, under any penalty the general court might see proper to inflict. 4. They made it a penal offense for a Quaker to come within their domain, threatening such a one with whippings, the stocks, and death. 5. They also punished those who should bring Quakers into the colony. 6. Or entertain them. 7. Required all good citizens to give information of the whereabouts of Quakers and authorized anybody to arrest them. 8 ID 87. They would not allow these people to vote. 9 ID 92. And seized without process their books. 10 ID 126, 130. And their horses. 11 ID 103, 126.
The reason given for depriving the Quakers of their horses is that by the use of those animals, they were enabled to escape from the officers who might otherwise apprehend them. But, as in most other actions of the Pilgrim Fathers, it is probable that cupidity was a leading motive for this confiscation. There appears to have been a scarcity of horses in the colony, as the towns are recommended to engage in the business of breeding them. Laws of the Colony, 103. It was, of course, far more agreeable to men of the Pilgrim Fathers' cast of mind to keep up the supply by seizing on the possessions of heretics than by undergoing the trouble and expense of breeding them, thus spoiling the Egyptians, carrying out their great principle that the just shall inherit the earth, and combining a religious duty with pecuniary profit, after the well-loved fashion of their kind. The case of these New England Puritans will be recurred to hereafter. enough has now been adduced to show that we cannot associate the recognition of religious equality in its true sense of the absolute equality of all religions and of no religion before the law with the establishment of any American colony. A number of features in our jurisprudence utterly inconsistent with religious equality are pointed out in Church and State, such as the exemption of church property from taxation, etc. A few facts may be mentioned here to show how vain and unsubstantial is the boast that religious equality is established and guaranteed among us even at the present day.
There is nothing in the federal Constitution to prevent the setting up of an established church by the states, but all powers not granted on one side or prohibited on the other by that instrument are expressly reserved. And thus, the power of setting up an established church is expressly guaranteed to every state. Only 5 states of our Union have thought it worthwhile in their constitutions to guard against the establishment of a state church. These are Alabama, Iowa, Louisiana, New Jersey, and South Carolina. 26 states, however, provide against any preference by the state of one form of religion over another. Under the very vague language of many other constitutions, it may be doubted whether the establishment could not be set up at the caprice of any legislature. In no less than 27 states is a religious test provided for office holders. One Vermont declares in her constitution that every sect ought to observe the Lord's Day, and Delaware that every sect should keep up some sort of religious worship. In order to hold office in Pennsylvania and Tennessee, a man must believe both in a God and a future state of rewards and punishments. But belief in God alone is enough for an office holder in Maryland, though not for a juror or witness. Only 17 states prohibit the absurdity of the voir dire, or examination of a witness as to his religious belief, in order to determine his reliability as a witness to the facts at issue. But the very existence and occasional practice of the voir dire shows that we are not one whit more logical on some subjects than were our ancestors 1,000 years ago. For the voir dire assumes that a man's statement about his belief is necessarily true. And if his statement of it includes certain elements, then it assumes that because he has told the truth on this subject when unsworn, therefore he cannot be relied upon to tell the truth on another subject after swearing to do so. It is plain that men who practice the voir dire cannot afford to smile at men who roasted their fellows to convince them of dogmatic truths.